Welcome to Moyer's Environmental Dialogues, Ocean River Shields of Achilles, with your host, Dr. Rob Moyer. Find out what others are doing and what you can do to create a greener and blue planet Earth. Now, here's Dr. Rob Moyer.
Hi, welcome. Today, we're talking about green crabs. This is New England's invasive critters, and could they be a culinary delight? And my guest today is Mary Park from greencrab.org. Hello, Mary.
Hello. Great to be speaking with you.
And you've come down from Maine, and you're living here in Cambridge.
Yes. So our organization is based in Cambridge, and we work with fishermen across New England and chefs.
Yeah, let me say a bit about who you are. Mary Park is executive director of greencrab.org, and Mary is a co-author of the Green Crab Cookbook. From the coast of Maine, Rockland, with a background in fishery science, Mary's roles include bringing Green Crab, a nonprofit, to commercial fisheries, organizing outreach and culinary events, and managing web design and social media platforms. Now, you know, we had a chance to talk, you know, before airtime and stuff. And, you know, these crabs are just, have just pushed out the rock crabs, and they seem to be ubiquitous and everywhere. And I was really surprised that what is just a big nuisance here in New England are something very special over in Venice, Italy. So tell us about the green crab and what you're learning about green crabs from Venice.
Absolutely. So our organization works to develop different markets for green crabs. And so even though they're an invasive species here in the United States on both coasts, you hop across the pond to Venice, Italy, they are a highly regarded artisanal species that people travel from all over the world to eat soft shell or for their caviar and also in other ways. And so our organization is trying to learn how we can bring the Venetian softshell and caviar industry over to the United States as a means of controlling these invasive populations. So to talk a little bit more about how the Venetian molt softshells, as I mentioned, it's an artisanal industry, and so it very much has remained unchanged for the past 200 years or so. And so these Venetian fishermen are going out into the Venetian lagoon, they're harvesting crabs, and under the hot Venetian sun, they're manually sorting them by holding the crabs up under the hot sun to see this tiny little difference in coloration between the two layers of shell. And so that's what they consider a good crab, is what they call it. And they being the moleccante, so green crabs are known as moleque in Venice, or moleque in Italy. And then they sort these crabs out once they see that they're about to molt. So they can then take the soft shells to market once they molt. And these crabs, they retail from anywhere from 30 to 90 euros a kilo, which is up to about $45 a pound here, which is a lot.
Again,
people travel from all over the world just for moleque season. And it's a huge event in Venice. So we're trying to learn from that industry.
So a 1 pound lobster is a pretty small lobster. How many green crabs in a pound?
So it does vary depending on the size of the crab. You can get anywhere from 20 to 8 crabs a pound, even 5 crabs a pound if they were really, really big.
Yeah, but still, $8 a crab, that's amazing if they're
big.
Yeah,
it is.
So this is quite a process. The Venetian fishermen are putting out what baskets or kind of like crab pots, and then you were saying that they haul them in and hold each one up to the light to see the way the sun penetrates through these. I guess the shells aren't as tough as ours. I mean, our crabs are pretty green, you know, they're kind of dark, but they're able to see through the crab with the light.
Yeah, so there's a color change that happens when the outer shell starts peeling away. So the old shell that they're going to lose starts separating from the new shell underneath, which is the soft shell. And so they're able, holding it up to the light, and that's one of the things that these Venetian fishermen are working with us and Manamet New Hampshire Sea Grant on, our partners, for molting soft shells, is understanding what that pre-molt sign looks like, and training fishermen so that they can identify that tiny little difference in coloration so that they know this crab is about to molt in X days.
And the good ones, they toss into a bucket of water that where they can molt or something, and the bad ones, I don't know, do they throw the bad ones back, or what do they do?
So they would have this big well of crabs that they would sort through, bent over, and the crabs that were about to molt, they would put into a separate container to allow them to molt. And so that would be actually within the Venetian Lagoon in a little wicker basket-like thing. And so if you look up photos of Venetian moeke, you'll see that it's essentially just all these floats made out of wood and wicker that the fishermen will keep the crabs in. And the really important thing is sorting out crabs that are about to molt and crabs that have molted so that the other crabs don't damage or attack them.
Right.
So it's very
corralling crabs into. Yeah, and you've got to keep them from attacking each other because they go soft. Do they get private housing or something? Yeah.
In a way, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Here in what Manamet New Hampshire Sea Grant has been doing a lot of is looking at how we could use lobster cars. And so they've been actually engineering individual little cells so that once the crab is about to molt, they would go into a little individual holding cell. And that would essentially prevent them from getting any tussles.
Yeah, because they're famously vicious with those big claws waving around, and they could really pull the other guy apart real quick. So you have to separate them.
Exactly.
And you can't, like, put bits of wood into the claws the way they do with lobsters to keep them from clipping each other.
No, that'd probably be a lot more work.
Yeah. Instead of making matchsticks, you could make little crab claw sticks or something. Yeah, I guess that's a little bit of work there. But, so then they would just watch them to see when they've molted, right? And then they scoop them up quick, I guess, after that.
Exactly. So they would routinely check in on the crabs to see if they're done half molted. And as soon as they molt, they're taken off to market that same day. Yeah.
Well, that's easy. You don't have to clean the crab. You can just eat the crab from left to right.
Exactly. So that's a great thing about soft-shell crab, is since it is this fresh crab right out of the ocean, is usually they just take it right out of the Venetian Lagoon. You'll drop in a little bit more lagoon water, toss it in some flour, and then right into the fryer.
That's super, because I once did a solo where they had me sit out on an island, you know, on the coast of Maine, for 3 days with a frying pan and not much else. And I managed to corner a crab, and I was so thrilled. And I looked at the size of him and how much fun I was talking to another critter on the shore that I didn't think it was worth killing him just to pull out the bits for meat and stuff, because, you know, it's difficult if you're cleaning a crab compared to a lobster. So it's great that you can eat, you know, the entire beast. And,
I was just going to say that looking at, you know, if a chef is going to be working with this new crab species, it's exactly what you're talking about, and that if they don't have to do sucking or cleaning or extra preparation, it's just so much easier to work with the whole crab.
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise it's, like, really intimidating to have to poke out the little bits of meat from the claws and stuff.
Yeah, it can be a little extra work, definitely.
and what are the average size crabs you're harvesting?
We'll see crabs anywhere from that you're pulling up in the typical trap could be anywhere from an inch across the carapace to 3 or 4 inches if they're larger.
Yeah.
But I would say most of them tend to be about 1.5 to 2.5 inches.
Yeah. That's
on
about
average.
The average size. You've got a wonderful film on your website, greencrab.org, but it's up close and you're inside the cage, so these crabs look like monsters because they're right up against the camera and stuff. it's really hard to tell the size. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that film by Nubar Alexanian of Walker Creek Media, it was really cool because it was one of our first chances to actually look inside the crab trap to see how fast these crabs are coming in. And I think it exemplifies just how abundant they are and how easy they are to catch, and how voraciously they'll go after anything from lobster bait to native species.
Right. I mean, they're just cascading into the trap. They're just like tripping over each other to get in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is. Not take a long time to haul up a full trap of green crab.
No, surprised. And they just put a piece of fish in there or something for bait.
Mm-hmm. So you can put anything from a hake rack or any, and when I say rack, I mean essentially the leftover bones from filleting a fish. And so
like
you can put anything from, from those leftovers in there to other small bait fish. And they tend to attract pretty quickly to that.
I hear that the lobstermen like to use crab for their bait, which we've had a problem with the herring fishery, with too much herring going to lobster bait when we're worried about how many herring are being caught. Is this an alternative? Are crabs that bait that could be used, green crabs, by, say, lobstermen?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're definitely useful as lobster bait, and they're also really popular bait for tautog and striped bass. So there's a ton of different bait applications that they could have. Yeah.
So tautog and striped bass, they're hook and line, so you're putting them on a hook, or how do you bait with crab for those fish? Yeah.
So what most people do, and it's great because it prevents the crab from being able to re-enter the ocean environment, but most people will cut the crab in half and then just hook the hook right through the center of the crab if they're going hook and line fishing. And it's a really popular choice, especially with recreational fishers.
Well, that's great. You don't have to buy big fish and chop them up or something.
Or
something. But that's really cool. Tell us a bit about the natural history of the green crab.
Yeah, so green crabs arrived on the east coast of the United States in the 1800s. And so their populations are pretty dense around Massachusetts and Maine. But it really wasn't until a couple years ago, about a decade ago, that populations really started to explode. And the reason being is that our oceans have been getting warmer, and so these cold winters are typically what kills off a lot of the green crab stock. And also, they reached a critical point in their population. And so it was around a couple years ago that we really, really started seeing them start to take over the softshell clam industry. And now, researchers such as Brian Beal in Maine have found that green crabs and the invasion of green crabs are likely responsible for the Maine softshell clam population decline. So not only are they a huge, huge problem for softshell clams and softshell clammers, but they also outcompete local crab species, and they also will destroy eelgrass territory when they're foraging for food. And so if you think about a green crab as being kind of like a lawnmower, while they're foraging for food, whether that be a small mollusk or any sort of shellfish or a baby lobster, they're often actually digging up the eelgrass and slicing it. And so a lot of people are under the impression that this is a huge driver behind declining eelgrass population, which is really important nursery habitat for a lot of the finfish species and shellfish species that we love to eat.
Yes, there's a whole lot in there that we're going to unpack. So for starters, you know, like 20, 30 years ago, I was a science teacher taking my students into tide pools. And there we could tell the green crabs, because they had have like 5 points on either side of the face. And they weren't as boxy as they were more kind of arced than the rock crabs were more boxy. And I think we're finding about 60, maybe 70%. I mean, there were more green crabs, but not a whole lot more green crabs. There were always rock crabs as well. And so apparently that's gotten worse and worse. No surprise there. And then they've gone out of the tide pools and into the clam beds, right? So they're now just chomping away at little clams, or because those are different habitats.
They are,
you don't think
fact,
of, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, one adult green crab can eat up to 40 half-inch clams in a day, which is absolutely insane. So if you think about even what the implications of a few crabs moving in 1 year to a new habitat, I mean, they can do a lot of damage very, very quickly. So it's a big concern to the industry.
And each crab has a lot of eggs. So there's a huge reproduction, right?
Yeah, so a female green crab can produce 185,000 eggs in a year, which is a whole lot of eggs. And so if you think about over time and how it doesn't take a long time for their populations to really grow once they're in new areas, it can be really, really scary, which is one of the reasons why monitoring and,
Yeah, it's very scary, and monitoring is really important. But, you know, they do spend time floating in the plankton where they're a main food source for all, you know, the plankton in general is zooplankton is chomped on by all kinds of stuff. So there's been this ratio of lots of plankton in order to have some surviving, but that's a lot of some crabs coming through there, settling down and scrabbling about. And then they have the strength to just crush, 40, lots of, what do you say, inch long clams? And of course, the clam starts to fall. Half inch clam, yeah. Yikes. Has that had, do you think that's had an effect on the clam industry? Yeah.
Yeah, so a few researchers at the University of Maine, I mean, including Brian Beal, who's been studying clams for years, they pretty firmly believe that declining Maine clam populations are attributed to predation by green crabs. And there's actually a few, Brian, along with some other people, are looking into, is the future of clamming dependent on utilizing technologies like clam boxes that actually prevent green crabs from harvesting these small clams? And that would be a huge, huge shift to the industry, but it might be necessary in the future.
Yeah, it would be a huge expense for the industry, but it would. However, you've got what's the alternative to that? You've got the alternative, right? Which is harvest the heck out of the green crabs.
Yeah, so what our organization is all about is creating markets for green crabs. And so we particularly focus on the culinary connection and how developing caviar or broth or soft shell markets could motivate people to remove green crabs consistently from local environments. And so we partner with chefs and fishermen to promote local supply networks, as well as wholesalers and processors. We also host outreach events, and we also just came out with a cookbook that is all about eating green crabs. Everything from moeke recipes from Venice to broth and stock and other recipes too, and caviar recipes. So there are
plenty of
ways to eat green crabs. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and learn more about the culinary side, the eating, cooking side of the green crab invasion, and how we can divert that flow of protein and food and stuff onto our plates and beautiful arrangements and stuff, tasty arrangements, to combat this scourge of crustaceans that are threatening my clam chowder and my fried clams and everything else. So we'll be right back after this break.
Don't know what I do.
On a Cape Cod shore, 16 striped bass fish and a horseshoe crab were found dead, killed by a harmful algal bloom. The town blamed excessive lawn fertilizer for polluting the water. They restricted lawn fertilizing to once a year. The state overruled, mandating five times a year. Though the striped bass died on a Falmouth shore, fertilizer pollution is a national problem, clogging our waterways. If you believe in our rights to clean water and beaches, if you want to stop the killing of fish by excessive fertilizer, please join with us. Make a donation for responsible stewardship. Acting together, we can have clean beaches and more fish. Please visit www.oceanriver.org. That's oceanriver.org.
You are listening to Moyer's Environmental Dialogues. To participate in today's discussion, you're welcome to call into the program at 1-866-472-5788. Again, that's 1-866-472-5788. You can also send an email to rob@oceanriver.org. Now, back to Dr. Rob Moyer.
Hi, we're talking about the green crab invasion of New England and how we've been, our intertidal areas and our offshore coastal waters have just been smothered in crab, where it used to be in green crab, which have the 5 points, and that's the same number as the letters in green. And whereas rock crabs have 4, and it's only R-O-C-K, and they're more boxy, but it used to be you'd see a couple of rock crabs and lots of green crabs, and now it's primarily green crabs, and they're just, their native home is on the other side of the Atlantic, and they came over and shipped ballast or something, and they're just wrecking havoc with our ecology. And so to the rescue is this little nonprofit called greencrab.org, and with me is Mary Park, the executive director. Mary, how can people find out more about your work online and contact you?
Yeah, so if you go to Green Crab R&D's website, which is just greencrab.org, you can learn about local suppliers, you can find species ID guides, and also our contact information and a bunch of free recipes. And you can also check out Manamit, which is one of our partner organizations. They've been doing a lot of work with green crabs, as well as the New Hampshire Sea Grant Green Crab Project. And so that's kind of our local little hub of organizations that are working to create markets for green crabs and especially looking into soft shell development and monitoring.
And you have a nice little blog, so you have postings on that. And there's a video that's got live action, crab action. Yeah, it's a great resource. I highly recommend it. And if you want to reach out to Mary, you can contact her through the website. We're going to be talking about events coming up. We're going to be talking about recipes. You're welcome to follow along just by going to greencrab.org. We were talking about, the whole web of life that you have of marine life under the waters, under the waves. And those green crabs aren't just marauding around tide pools where I used to see them, but they, as you were saying, they're heading out into clam flats and having a real impact on half-inch clams, a bad impact. I don't know if it's devastating, but it's certainly got the clammers concerned, and it's got me concerned because I like to eat clams. But one of the most precious habitats we have here in the Gulf of Maine are the eelgrass beds. There's just so few. It's so easy for anchoring boats to tear them up, and it's so easy for things scratching the bottom to disturb them. And then they are sensitive to water quality. So now that we've come so far and so much work has been done in cleaning up our harbors and cleaning up what our rivers are putting out, that there's hope for eelgrass coming out. But then along come the crabs. So tell us more about green crabs and eelgrass.
Yeah, so when green crabs are feeding, they are often digging through the mud, trying to get shellfish or small fish to eat. And when they're doing that, they're functioning essentially as a lawnmower, slicing the eelgrass. A lot of researchers have now believed that declining eelgrass populations are partially attributed to green crab's predation and foraging activity. So when we think about all the species that are affected by green crabs in turn, from baby lobsters and shellfish in general to bird species that are feeding on the eelgrass, to finfish species that are using eelgrass as nursery habitat, there can be a really, really big impact. And so some researchers that we've been working with in green crab monitoring, including Alyssa Novak at Boston University, have actually gone in and are working with reseeding efforts along with their monitoring programs for green crabs. So it is also really scary to think about if populations of green crabs are to increase, which they likely will in the future, what that means for these already vulnerable populations of eelgrass.
Yeah, it's not looking good, but it was really cool the way the scientist was able to, you know, have, because it's a plant. It's not like algae. It doesn't have holdfast. It has real roots. And the scientist mm-hmm. was able to have little rooted plants that we could see her planting them, you know, like planting, plants in the ground, you know. It's just really exciting that she could be literally just being like Johnny Appleseed.
Exactly.
And you know, this is a great thing about Sea Grant is that they're so tied into communities. So is there an opportunity for citizens to help marine life restoration along these different areas?
Absolutely. So if you go to the New Hampshire Green Crab Project page, one awesome thing that they do that is led by Gabby Bratt, who runs the program, is they have these green crab hunts. And so people can actually, they usually gather at the Seacoast Science Center, and people from Massachusetts to Maine can gather in coastal New Hampshire to go on a collective citizen science adventure. So you can learn how to identify green crabs, how to find them, and then help log data.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. When I was a science teacher in seventh grade in New Hampshire, the Seacoast Science Center, the Odeona Point, was the best place to take my classes because they had not only have fantastic tide pools, but they had public bathrooms. You know, and so it's really important to have the combination of the two. But they have such wonderful programs, and it's a great family activity to get together and go hunting green crabs. And then the UNH Sea Grant page, which is you can get to from greencrab.org, has opportunities to help with eelgrass restoration and surveying and stuff. So there's so many wonderful opportunities to get families engaged. I mean, dads like to look good with their kids doing stuff, and this is a great way to get into the outdoors. So these terrible crabs, they're taking on the eelgrass, they're taking on the clams, and then is there much interaction between crabs and lobster?
Yeah, so a big issue with crabs and lobsters is that green crabs go for the same food sources. So lobsters are going to eat a lot of the detrital matter that's on the bottom of the ocean, along with a lot of these same shellfish species that green crabs are going to eat. But another issue is that hybrid populations in Canada that have now been shown to be more ferocious, more aggressive, and larger have actually been seen to eat lobster spawn. And so this is of a really big concern if these hybrid species in Canada and the upper Gulf of Maine come down and start eating more and more lobster spawn in the Gulf of Maine, that could be a huge problem.
Yes, and what are they hybridizing with?
So they're hybridized of some of the northern and southern populations of green crab, two subspecies. There's two subspecies, yes.
Subspecies.
And so these northern and southern species essentially were able to hybridize in Canada, and they've been shown to be so much more ferocious than the non-hybridized species that we have down here in Massachusetts and more south. And I think a scary thing to think about, and why it is really important to, I mean, it's also illegal to transfer crabs in between states. But one of the reasons it's important is when we're setting up an industry and we're thinking about what could happen if Canadian green crabs were introduced to Massachusetts waters, it could be devastating. And so that's why it's so important to know where the crabs are coming from and also to promote local markets and really educate people on the dangers of reintroducing crabs and also the legalities.
Well, it's really hard because the crabs, as we were saying earlier, spend an early stage in their life floating around as zooplankton, and they just get sucked mm-hmm. into ship ballast, you know, and we've got so much good traffic, you know, between Canada, between the Maritimes and New England, that it's just a matter of time. So bravo for crab.org for just harvesting more and more crabs, because you don't care whether it's a northern subspecies or a southern subspecies of green crab or the hybridized. They all cook up about the same, I would think.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So they're wreaking havoc with lobsters, and hopefully, you know, the lobsters are chowing down some green crabs when they're small, but something's happening. At least the lobsters are doing okay in the Gulf of Maine. At least that's what we're hearing from the lobstermen. I guess the center of the population is moving north with warming waters, though, so that the good trapping of yesterday isn't necessarily the same in the southern portions. Do you see warming waters affecting the green crab?
Yes. So, and this is something that Manomet scientist Marissa McMahon's talked a lot about, but populations of green crabs are expected to do very, very well in warming waters. And the reason that is, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, cold winters are really important for controlling their population. And so as we start to see warmer and warmer winters, we will expect less and less crabs will be killed off by those cold winters. And also, these hybridized green crabs will also likely do very, very well in both colder and warmer waters. It's pretty scary.
Well, that's not good. That's surprising. They're doing better in cold water, yet we want cold water for them to die back. Or, like I said earlier, maybe they just go offshore, and so they don't really disappear. They just hunker down or avoid the cold, and then their back is more voracious than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we've covered the ecology of the green crab. And, let's tell people how to tell the sexes apart.
Yeah. And this is something that somebody told me at a festival sometime that they found useful for the blue crab industry, but when you're looking at the underside of the crab and you look at the shape of the apron on the female, it's going to be kind of shaped like the Capitol building. And so it has kind of a rounded dome-like shape with a little point on the top. And then if you look at the male crab, it's a much more narrow piece. And so it kind of looks like the Washington Monument. So if you think Capitol Building and Washington Monument, that's an easy way to tell them apart. And we also have a guide online for differentiating males and females if anybody wants to look at pictures. This time of year, too, you'll also start to see some of the females are gravid with eggs. And so if they had been harvested maybe a couple weeks before, they would have delicious caviar inside. But if you see a female that has this big orange ball that's starting to come out of the apron, that means it's about to release a lot of eggs. So feel free, if you see one of those on the beach or anywhere in the intertidal, to remove and smash to help control populations.
Yeah, just get it out of the sea and toss it way inland and
exactly.
Or smash or whatever. Yeah. Right. So, you know, the lobsters, we know how the meat's in the tail, but in crabs, that tail is wrapped around, so that's why they're not shaped like a lobster. And the wraparound is what you're calling the apron, and it's between that tail and the body that the females hold the eggs. And so you were saying that it's not, once the eggs are bulging out, it's no longer caviar, it's just plain eggs, or is there a different stages
so
or something?
Once they extrude the eggs in that part of the tail, it's really not good to eat as caviar anymore. But before they extrude their eggs, and in Venice it's very popular, it's known as massanete, and it's essentially this delicious, fragrant caviar that you can find both in the fall and this time of year in kind of the second caviar season that's a little bit smaller.
Wow, who can imagine? I mean, sturgeon have caviar, but who thought that those stupid green crabs would have such an important ingredient as that? So that's a reason to harvest females, is to go for the caviar.
Absolutely, and why not remove a bunch of pre-reproductive females from the environment that are about to release tons and tons of eggs? So it goes hand in hand with our mission.
This is really interesting. It's time for another break, and when we come back, we're going to dive into the culinary aspects of how to benefit and enjoy green crabs out of their natural habitat.
Connecting local stewardship with global support, the Ocean River Institute is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping people and groups make a difference where they live and work. We believe that many environmental issues can best be addressed by people taking action in their own communities and regions. It's not the large national entities, but the small, localized, or newly formed groups that often need help to achieve their goals. That's where the Ocean River Institute comes in. We maintain a network of eco-stewards and ORI partners, connecting them with resources and services to help them maximize their impact, expand their capacity, and weather unexpected setbacks. ORI actions and events offer opportunities to make a difference, to go the distance, and you can volunteer to be an ORI Eco Steward. To discover more, visit us online at www.oceanriver.org. That's www.oceanriver.org. The Ocean River Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to helping people and groups make a difference where they live and work through environmental stewardship and science. You are listening to Moyer's Environmental Dialogues. To participate in today's discussion, you're welcome to call into the program at 1-866-472-5788. Again, that's 1-866-472-5788. You can also send an email to rob@oceanriver.org. Now, back to Dr. Rob Moyer.
Hi, we're talking with Mary Park, Executive Director of GreenCrab.org. And we've got these green crabs that are just marauding around our shores. And during the break, Mary mentioned that you can just go out to the intertidal zone with a bucket, and there are better times. So what were the better times to collect crabs?
So it's not so much about timing as much as it is knowing where to look for them. And so we're actually going to be releasing a guide at greencrab.org that's going to talk about how you can go out and forage for soft shells if you're interested. And a lot of it is just knowing how to look under certain patches of seaweed and in certain environments and what that looks like.
Great. Yeah, the only timing would be if you wanted them soft instead of regular. But the important thing is to get out there and find them. And you have recipes for both kinds of crabs, right?
Exactly. So we have recipes for soft shell crabs. We have recipes for hard shell crabs. We have recipes for larger crabs and even smaller green crabs. So we have we kind of start off at least, and we have recipes both online at greencrab.org and in our new cookbook. So we start off the cookbook and also provide online kind of the basic ways in which you can cook with green crabs. So starting off with what we talked about before, which is the moeke or softshell crab, there's kind of two main ways in which you can prepare them. And so the first is the Venetian way, where you literally just take the crab from lagoon water and put it in some flour and put it in the fryer. But you can also prepare it kind of more like a blue crab, where you would trim the sides and take off a couple of the leg pieces to really just focus on that meaty morsel. But a great part about softshell green crabs, unlike softshell blue crabs, is that they're smaller, they're just a little bit more intense in flavor, they're a little bit sweeter. And just overall, they do have less soft shell and less shell. So they are very much a more meaty morsel that you can just pop in your mouth.
Yum. And what about the hard ones?
Yeah, so you can use hard shells in a wide variety of ways, too. And so the first way in which you can cook with hard shell crabs, which is probably my favorite way to eat green crabs, is to shuck them for their caviar. And so caviar, as I mentioned before, is available. It's in the fall as well as around this time of year. You'll start to see a smaller caviar season where less frequently females have caviar, but you can still find quite a few with them. And so this caviar, which is known as massanette, it's served in a couple ways traditionally in Venice. So either you can have it right out of the shell with a little bit of salt, maybe a little bit of fresh lemon, kind of like eating an oyster on the half shell. Or you can also saute the massanette with a little bit of white wine or vinegar in a saucepan. And then we also even have some recipes in our cookbooks, like Heather Atwood's Terra Masalata, which is blended caviar with also some soaked bread and lemon, and that's a beautiful Greek mezze dish. And we also have some other recipes, such as our massanette crab cakes that have sweet potato and caraway seeds and this caviar, and it's an absolutely delicious fried little morsel.
And you can have it on pastas and potatoes and
Exactly. You can have it on pastas. So we have a few pasta dishes in there. You could have it on even a lobster roll. We've heard of people putting the caviar on top of lobster rolls. It's caviar. I mean, you can put it on pretty much anything, and it is delicious. And it also, it does have this umami quality. So like the caviar, as well as the stalks and broths and really any green crab that you're going to eat, it's this softer, less seafoody flavor that is just absolutely delicious in a wide variety of dishes. But you can also use green crabs to make a stock, and it's one of the easiest ways that you can cook with them. And so if you have anywhere from 12 green crabs to 150 green crabs, depending on your stock or your stock pot size, obviously, you can crush them up and have a delicious stock in less than a half an hour. And it's also a really, really easy way of serving a lot of people green crab and doing a little bit less prep work. And you can use that with caviar crabs. You can use that with small crabs, with larger crabs. We have also two recipes in our cookbook. And the second is a ginger and kelp stock. And that's kind of with a bit of more preparation involved. And so that would involve taking off some of the carapace as well as the gills and the eye stalks. And that's a slightly more refined stock that's a little bit lighter. But you can you can do a whole bunch of things with them. And you can even make a New England-style she crab soup. So traditionally, she crab soup is made with the roe and stock of blue crabs. But you can also make it with the roe and stock of green crabs. And other people have even reduced the stock for risottos and pasta dishes. And we actually have a Campari tomato and tarragon pasta dish that has a green crab broth that is less than 20 minutes to whip up. And for small crabs, I mean, a great part about the small crab is that they have a little bit less, their shell is a little bit less thick. And so people like Aliwak Adams of the Brunswick Inn have fried this little crab whole and called it a popcorn crab, where you can literally just pop the crab in your mouth. It's like a little crisp. And then you can also kind of treat it a little bit more like a soft shell. And so we also have a pizza recipe in our book that is a grilled small crab pizza recipe. And so if they are about, you know, a centimeter to an inch and a half in size, they're a bit smaller, you can definitely fry them whole, and they're delicious that way too.
Who'd have thought it? And then you have fermented crab?
Yeah, so we don't have any recipes in our book, but my co-author, Tan Tai, she runs Green Crab Cafe, which is an incredible blog that is fully dedicated to cooking with green crabs. And so she's recently been experimenting with some fermented green crab recipes, along with Tanam in Somerville. They've been creating some fermented green crab recipes too, working R&D.
And so how do we learn more about this? Now that we're all hungry.
So if you want, it's greencrab.org is where Green Crab R&D has all of our information. If you want to order a copy of the cookbook, if you need to find a local fisherman or a supplier, we're also Green Crab Project on Instagram and Facebook. And we're also going to be having tasting events all throughout the summer in the Boston and New York and other areas too.
Right. So you have one coming up on the 13th of June.
We do. We were selected for this year's Readable Feast Cookbook Competition that we're really excited for. And so we're going to be signing books at the Innovation and Design Building. And that is June 13th. And then on July 8th, we're going to be hosting a book signing and tasting event at Trident Booksellers, which is right on Newbury Street in Boston. And Trident is going to be, we're either going to be serving the sheet crab soup or the ginger and kelp stock, and we'll be signing cookbooks, and we're also going to do an interactive shucking and sorting demo. And so that will be free and open to the public and a great chance for people in the Boston area to try green crabs. We don't have dates set right now, but we're also going to be doing some restaurant pop-ups this summer at places like The Little Donkey and Benedetto and Cambridge. So stay tuned to greencrab.org, and we will be soon sharing date information for those events.
And you're going to New York?
Yeah, so if you're in the New York area, on August 8th, we're going to be hosting an event with Bill Telepan at the Institute of Culinary Education. And so that's going to be another interactive event that is focused on cooking multiple green crab dishes, exploring the green crab cookbook, and also working with some researchers or hearing from some researchers who are working in monitoring and remediation efforts. We'll also be at the Boston Local Food Fest hosting our Touch Tank and signing cookbooks. We're also going to probably be having two other tastings in New York, too, if not three. So stay tuned for additional tastings with some New York restaurants.
So that'll be in August, or you don't know?
That will be July through August.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So you got events in Boston and events in New York, and probably you'll have events in New Hampshire and Maine. But that's,
yeah,
you got to
so
follow your calendar.
The Manamet New Hampshire Sea Grant, I've already started working with some local restaurants. So Moxie in Portsmouth recently served a green crab dish, working with New Hampshire Sea Grant. And we'll definitely be sharing those events and more information on our website too.
So bring your buckets to greencrab.org and prepare to be fed well and help save the ocean by removing these noxious critters that have been destroying clams and seagrass and not making things easy for lobsters either. Bravo. And this sounds really delicious.
They are. They're honestly an incredibly tasty species, and even though they might not be the most popular thing to eat right now, who knows, in 10 years, it could be the next lobster.
Well, yeah, and lobster popcorn, crab, green crab, you know, the small ones, they're small enough that the hard shell is not so much an issue if you make it, you know, if you toast them and stuff, I guess.
Exactly, or deep fry them.
If you what?
Or if you deep fry them.
Oh, deep fry
them,
right.
That tends to crisp up the shell very nicely.
Yeah. Yeah, who needs French fries? You can have French fried green crabs.
Exactly.
Oh, well, thank you, Mary Parks. This is fabulous. Thank you for taking the time to tell us about the work you're doing at Green Crab. And for more information, be sure to visit Mary at greencrab.org. Got a few minutes here. How would you like to summarize this episode of New England's invasive critters or culinary device, the green crab?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think that we're in a time where people are very much aware of sustainable seafood and the issues associated with eating sustainably, or what we should be eating and what we shouldn't be eating. And I think that green crabs are really, really unique in that it's not only something that can help the environment, but they are delicious. And also, a lot of fishermen who are involved in fishing green crabs were previously in other industries, or people who are seeing their industries, such as lobstering or softshell clamming, start to decline because of climate change, overfishing, and the invasive green crab. And so I encourage anyone who can to try green crabs if you see them available. And even if you don't, one thing that we really encourage people to do at Green Crab R&D is just walk up to your local fish counter and ask them if they are serving green crabs or if they've thought about it, even if you know that they're not serving them. Because oftentimes those fish counters and fish markets, their wholesalers are already bringing in green crabs for the bait market. And so it's pretty easy for them to transition to provide a special order or even start carrying them in the store. And again, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out on greencrab.org, and we'd be happy to answer your question or connect you to someone in our network who can.
Mary, thank you. Well said. Thank you so much for coming on to this radio show.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure.
And that's it for another episode of Moyer's Environmental Dialogues. Until next time, please take care of yourself, and then take a moment to take some care of this planet of ours.
Thanks again for joining us this week on Moyer's Environmental Dialogues. Please tune in for more with Dr. Rob Moyer next Thursday at 12 noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll talk again then.